800 children, but it was traced back to the adoption from the Native hospital, where mothers were pressured by different religious orders to give up children who were illegitimate. And of course, the concept of a fatherless child is an alien concept to Alaska Native societies. We have always had single mothers, and children have always been placed with extended family members. So the removal, it appears, is continuing, and probably even at a greater rate than we know.
Oren, you wanted to say something, and then Rena.
Yes, I wanted to make just a couple of clarifying remarks on the content of the existing subsistence provisions, particularly in Title 8 of ANILCA. One thing that's very explicit in the provisions of Title 8 of ANILCA is that the subsistence regime that it sets up is not in any way based on a native, non-native distinction. It's fundamentally based on a rural, non-rural distinction. Now, Title 8 of ANILCA may be a good law and it may be a very bad law, but it is certainly not a law which has anything to do with recognizing, much less promoting, a special place for indigenous people in society, unlike the place of any other recognized minority. To come back to a question that Tom raised at the very beginning of this roundtable, which I think is really one of the fundamental issues that we all need to address. Is there, should there be, can there be a place for Native peoples, indigenous peoples, unlike the place of any other minority in society? ANILCA Title 8 is a legal regime which cuts directly in the other way from that. And so if you really, it doesn't suggest any opposition to rural subsistence users, including natives, playing a significant part in the decision-making process. That's not the problem. The problem is it rests on a very direct, fundamental proposition that runs counter to the idea that there should be a special place unlike that of any others. And so if one really wants to promote that goal, which I think is a very interesting goal, one has to attack ANILCA root and branch.
Yes, Oren, might I intervene at this point? I think that your point is a vital one. And indeed, we had a round table in October on subsistence for 4 days and discussed the current Alaska subsistence regime at length. That has been thrown into some confusion by the recent judgment of the Supreme Court of Alaska, and that's something that the Commission will have to deal with in due course. I don't want us to be sidetracked onto a discussion of subsistence because we've been through that. It's in my mind and in all our minds, but I think what I'd like to do is, Rena wanted to say something arising out of the earlier discussion, and I was going to ask Oscar or Verna if they wish to as well, since there may be two views about the purport of Sheldon's earlier remarks relating to schools and so on. But what I wanted to do after that was to turn to the place of Native peoples in the Western world. We know what the U.S. Constitution says. We know what Alaska law says. We've studied those, discussed it at length. What I'm really interested in finding out from the folks that we've got here is whether international law, as it is emerging, can be called an aid, so to speak, whether it does indeed reveal a tendency to acknowledge the right of indigenous peoples to the things Sheldon was talking about, self-government, land, and the point that Oren made. Does it reveal, as a matter of principle, the right of Native peoples to subsistence?
ethnic women particularly? Are ethnic women involved? Are what kind of board are they involved in the planning? And when I say ethnic minority local church, I say EMLC. We look at the percentage of ethnics involved. Who sits on the board? Youth, women, and the older people. And if they were involved in the planning and the monitoring that will be done. So it's not only funding, but we also help in advocacy, in building networks, referring to other ecumenical agencies within our building, or we help facilitate programs. And of course, the number one need among all of our ethnics, Native people, is leadership development. And so it's a constant effort to work on leadership development. And so we find people who will try to find people and fund people to go to seminars, workshops, and we have one, some of you who live in the Washington area know IMPACT, which is brings people from all over the U.S. to hear the congressional Congress people present their legislation and the issues that we hear about. And we find people from the different four ethnic groups that we send to the IMPACT that's coming up the last part of this month. And we do have a couple of Native people, Methodists, and I'm sure there are Presbyterians, Lutherans, others will send Native people from their groups to Washington for the IMPACT meeting. And we also, when we get proposals, we look to see if these are people, how many Native people, where they are, what their project is, and we do have many non-Methodists who apply to our agency. And where the church once did for Natives, now we have to work with the Natives. And we hear and we work upon groups with a self-determination. Are these people involved in the self-determination effort, and how will we help them to be more self-determining? And so, as I mentioned, I came from Oklahoma, and I look at my own particular Indian Mission Conference. For many years, we had white superintendent who presided over our work. We had white deaconesses. And then about somewhere in the 60s, I was away from home at the time. In the 60s then, the Indians decided that it was time that they took over and did their own work. And so it was, I guess, kind of a divisive issue, and some of our Indians and Bishop weren't on speaking terms, and some of our Indian pastors were on the outs or the outside. But now we no longer have a white general superintendent. Well, of course, we do have the bishop, who is white, and of course he comes from the appointed through the general conference. But we no longer have white deaconesses, and we have in Oklahoma, particularly, we have all Indian pastors who can only move within the bounds of their conference. They can't do the serve communion or do other ordination outside of the bounds. So there are special kinds of education that are only applicable to them, but they are able to move within the bounds of their own conference, because the men, these people say, once their men or women, now we have, there are five women who are pastors and one in the seminary. They say that once these people go to the seminaries, when they come back, they're not fit to serve. They're no longer fit. And we hear this about the education of our people who go out and come back, and somehow or other they're not able to relate, and they're not acceptable. And or more often, they're snatched up by other conferences. If they have you know, the English-speaking, so they are taken to other areas and do not come back to their own people. And I guess a lot of what I'm hearing from Sheldon and from what just Verna was saying, that, you know, brings back some very, very vivid pictures, because I went to government school. And I know the
new ideas, new strategies would be evolving. And that's the nature of both societies, both cultures. They change and evolve. Now, let me just offer two ideas that that might be, I only mention this because the discussion has been a useful one, and it may be that I am able, in a limited fashion, to clarify it, but the notion of subsistence comes up again and again, and wherever I was in the bush, that was the dominant theme, land and subsistence. And the point that Orrin Young made is absolutely at the core of all of this. Are native people entitled, as a matter of native status, to a subsistence preference? Now, that isn't a notion that should necessarily be laughed out of court and dismissed out of hand. There is a place in this state where there is a subsistence preference at Metlakatla. There is a 3,000-foot exclusive native fishing zone around the island. In the state of Washington, Native people have a right to take 50% of the catch on the Columbia River. And that's America. It isn't some alien notion that crept in to an otherwise pristine constitutional situation. In Canada last year, the Inuvialuit of the Western Arctic reached a settlement with the government of Canada that gave them exclusive rights to certain species, ownership of polar bears and grizzly bears, and certain other species that have slipped my mind at the moment, and in addition, a subsistence preference based on the fact that they are the native people of that region, and the other rural subsistence users are to hold for their lifetimes a right to engage in subsistence. Their preference will be shared with that of the native people, but after each of them dies, that permit dies with them, and there will be, perhaps at the end of the century or thereabouts, a more or less exclusively native subsistence preference in a region of the Arctic that and climate and geography is very similar to much of Alaska. Indeed, the people are the same people, speaking the same language as the Inupiat. The other notion that emerges from our discussion this morning is this. We heard from Verna and Raina and the other, and Oscar and the other educators about native education. It may be that in urban areas, self-determination means, it means the same thing in the rural areas too, no doubt, but in urban areas, it may mean that self-determination takes the form of the right of native people to determine what kind of education their children shall receive in the midst of great metropolitan areas like Anchorage. I don't know. But these things are evolving and emerging, and we will see where they take us. Now, it seems to me that this afternoon what we might usefully do is what we talked about earlier, and that is to ask Bernie Nietzschman and Doug Sanders and Clem Chartier and Henry Hsu and Sandy Davis to talk about the recent developments in international law, what is emerging at the ILO, the United Nations, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, the International Court of Justice. I think those things are relevant, and I would like to hear what these folks have to say, since they will be dispersing, some of them later today and others tomorrow, and I think it is an opportunity that should not be missed. And I would also hope that before the afternoon is out, Professor Hanke, who began this discussion yesterday, or was it the day before, might offer some thoughts, bringing us full circle. Because these ideas, as we understand them in terms of Western law, international law, began with the Spaniards, with Vitoria and Las Casas, and we are still discussing these same ideas today. So that's what I would like to do this afternoon. We know that the North Slope Borough has invited us all to come to their office nearby, and Oren will lead the delegation over there to take a look at this geographic information system. Might I also take this opportunity of saying that through the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, the North Slope Borough has, support of the North Slope Borough has been indispensable to the work of this commission, and we are grateful to them. Now, I know others want to speak, but if we are going to get through our schedule, I have to take advantage of my role as chairman, and yes?
Advantage of my role as a woman.
Yes.
To scold.
Well,
okay, Justice Bridger, I'm going to tell you that I want to answer David.
Colonialism has created this court, and I'm in no position to challenge it. That's the first principle, and that's not what international law scholars would normally put down as a first principle. That is not the principle of international law that Marshall is remembered for, but it is explicit in his judgments. And he then goes on, in a sense, to do what other judges have done in both Canada and the United States, which in some ways is to vindicate colonialism, to say, yes, it's colonialism, but there are certain kinds of principles involved. Yes, we're not going to deal with the essential rightness of what happened, but we're not going to say that there were no rights. But all that Marshall does in the judgments, and indeed all that the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council do in the closest Canadian parallel, the St. Catharines Milling case, is to in fact vindicate or affirm the legal validity of state actions which have already occurred. Now, the state actions which have already occurred in both countries, and in both instances, it is a process of negotiating treaties between the colonial power and local tribal groups. One says, oh, right, if Marshall made things up and vindicated what had already happened, what were the roots of what had already happened? And we have required, over the last decade or so, revisionist historians to go back beyond some of the myths to try to fit it together. So I'd cite a book like Jennings' book, The Invasion of America, as one which roots the practice of signing treaties in the reality of contact between significant populations, one of which had intensive patterns of land use and the other which wanted to establish intensive patterns of land use in the same area. And it was a practical political reality which led to these patterns. Indeed, the truth was, with populations of the density of the Indian populations in New England, it was simply not possible for the numbers of Europeans to take over the area without some recognition of indigenous rights in the process. And it's that practical recognition which is affirmed later by Marshall in the famous judgments, and by Canadian courts in upholding treaty-making patterns as being legally real in Canada.
Right.
Now, so what I suggest is that in that whole era, the question of the rights of acquisition of territory is essentially papered over. One can, however, go back to the Spanish period, where the propriety of the acquisition itself was discussed. And Victoria give certain grounds, comments on certain of the pretensions that Spain held out to justify the acquisition of territories, such as, and here indeed we get the recycling of, or perhaps the first cycling of material that is recycled constantly since, you get notions that they are certainly people can have rights, but the Indians are too stupid, to which Vitoria replies that they may not be very bright, but there are a lot of Spanish peasants that don't appear much brighter, and we recognize land rights in them. Vitoria does a very interesting analysis of of sort of premises of equality in terms of paganism and degree of education and these kinds of things. But that kind of analysis, and in some ways, Vitoria plays a card that I think he did not anticipate the use that would be made of later. Because he said an acquisition of day, although nation states can refer to the International Court of Justice questions which involve the rights of groups other than recognized nation states. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights has created an international forum, the Human Rights Committee, with an adjudicatory power for some states which have signed what is referred to as the optional protocol, which allows that procedure. We have this slow development of institutions with technical competency and recognized adjudicatory roles. Again, I would note that the United States is outside of this development, but since it is a signatory to the United Nations Charter, which itself is a treaty, it is associated with the major organs of the United States, such as the Commission and the Subcommission. It was in the context of the human rights law relating to racial discrimination that a specific concern with indigenous populations arose. A special rapporteur's study was commissioned by the Subcommission on the Prevention of Discrimination and the Protection of Minorities on the question of racial discrimination. In around 1970 or 1971, the rapporteur in a preliminary report said to the Subcommission that the situation of indigenous populations was a special, separate situation which merited an independent investigation and recommended that such an investigation take place. A special study was commissioned by the Subcommission, the Cobo study, which was completed last year. So there is now at the UN level a study on, under the title Discrimination Against Indigenous Populations, plus a special body, the Working Group on Indigenous Populations, which is under the Subcommission on the Prevention of Discrimination and the Protection of Minorities. Both of these, the institution and the report, are in United Nations terminology aimed at the development of standards in international law relating to the treatment of indigenous populations. It is assumed by many who are involved in this that the development will take the following steps, that there will be the preparation of a declaration which will set out certain standards, which will go to the General Assembly to be adopted at that level. Therefore, that will be a declaration like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which can set standards and have influence on customary international law, but which is not in itself a binding part of international law. Many who are involved anticipate going on to a second stage in which a convention is developed, a treaty which would articulate standards, which would then be binding as a matter of international law on the nation states which were signatories to it. These developments have occurred within the context of human rights, not in the context of decolonization. Nevertheless, the boundaries between human rights as individual rights, human rights as collective rights, and human rights as involving the collective political right of self-determination, those boundaries are not maintained well or scrupulously in the modern international law of human rights. Therefore, the two international human rights conventions, which came into force in 1976, while primarily oriented towards individual rights in the major traditions of United States human rights law and French human rights law, Those conventions both begin with the statement of the right of self-determination of peoples, a collective political right recognized outside of the institutional framework that is handling decolonization within the United Nations at this point. In other words, this, the area of self-determination outside of formal decolonization now recognized, is an area of international law at the UN level without a responsible, competent body other than those in the human rights field. The other factor in terms of this law of human rights is that the only international recognition at this point in conventional international law of the rights of minorities is Article 27 of the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights, which came into force in 1976. Again, while that's a, I certainly call it a group rights section, while it is a group rights, minority rights section, it again is put in the context of the international law on human rights. So the international law of human rights is often rejected by indigenous populations as an inadequate framework for the articulation of their goals because of its presumed individual rights orientation. In general, that is true, but the international law of human rights, as it's developed over the last 10, 20 years, has included elements which indigenous peoples, in fact, have used and are compatible. Just one final point. The structure of the United Nations is one in which the, well, rights may now be recognized on levels other than that of the nation state. There's still very little in the way of a departure from the structure of the United Nations in which only nation states are the actors. Nevertheless, even on this point, there has been some movement. And the recognition of the Palestine Liberation Organization and SWAPO as having observer status is a clear departure from the premise that only recognized nation states can be involved in the formal structure of United Nations bodies.
Thank you, Doug, for that masterly analysis of recent and not so recent developments in international law. Well, Mr. Henke, we turn to you now, sir,
Mr. Chairman, I have just a footnote to this erudite exposition by Douglas Sanders. Although I am a citizen of the United States and live in Amherst, Massachusetts, I now speak as an informal member of the Hispanic tribe. I don't know whether by international law one can belong to two tribes. Is that possible? If so, I do. I now speak to make certain that Spain and Hispanic contributions are properly recognized when it comes to international law. There was a book published about a half century ago by James Brown Scott, then director of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, entitled The Spanish Origin of International Law. He'd been to Salamanca, had studied the published works of Francisco de Vitoria, and in other ways he argued that the true basis for international law had been constructed by Spain. So much so that when I had the problem of getting a book published, you know, young historians often have a difficult time getting their valuable contributions to learning published, I turned to Dr. Scott because I discovered in the Spanish archives a whole volume of unpublished treatises on the rights of Spain to the New World, on the relations of Spain to the Indians, natives of the New World, not only America, but also in the Philippines. And there was Dr. Scott, willing to put up, I think, $500 to get this Cuerpo de Documentos published in Spanish in Mexico. Unfortunately, it came out in 1943, during the war, very bad paper. Nobody's read it. But there you will see not only questions relating to territory, which was one of the important focuses of Douglas Sanders, but all various aspects of relations between peoples. And remember, they were the ones who first met the peoples of the New World from Europe. And they didn't discuss merely these arcane subjects, which sometimes our international lawyers do, but realities. For example, there was Alonso Sanchez, a Jesuit. He published several treatises. He was very hot against the Muslims in the Philippine Islands. And he said, with respect to these ancient enemies of Spain, who attacked Christian Spain during the Middle Ages and occupied Spain, we should declare only war by fire and by sword. Not only was there a whole volume of treatises, but I found enough references to other treatises. So I prepared a bibliography year by year of every treatise I'd heard about which concerned these questions. Well, and after this volume came out, a very distinguished Jesuit scholar today, Ernest Burrus, published a splendid edition of the treatise, or rather the university lectures by the Augustinian Alonso de la Vera Cruz, professor at the University of Mexico, on all these questions following Las Casas. So that I just want to make certain that
important component. You simply do not have at the present time a consensus at the international level of a balancing of the importance of these two items. If there was a consensus, why I go into this is that if there was a consensus, then it might be quite possible to judge standards of compliance. Without the consensus, we're still at a rather preliminary stage. You do have attempts at assessing compliance, number of non-governmental organizations. Indeed, the United States government itself, for the last number of years, does an annual report on compliance with human rights standards. But the criteria which are used in determining that would not be universally accepted as being complete in terms of the questions of adherence which should be examined.
Oran Young and then David Case, you wanted to ask something.
I wanted to make an American supplement to the Canadian interpretation of American politics, which you just heard. And let me offer 3 points about this question that Tom has raised. The first point is this, that it is hard to get treaties ratified in the United States Senate. Whether it's easier or harder than in other places is a separate question. It is hard, and it's getting harder. It's getting harder because the post-war bipartisan foreign policy consensus that was operative in the United States in the late 40s and 50s and into the 60s is clearly breaking down. The diversity of viewpoints and the differences in value outlooks and perspectives that are reflected in the composition of the Senate is growing all the time, making it harder to put together a majority, a simple majority, for anything, much less a two-thirds majority. Therefore, in order to get a treaty ratified, it requires a fairly substantial act and exercise of political will. An exercise of political will means in this context is a willingness on the part of the administration to expend a fair number of political chips. They've got to want it badly enough to be willing to expend some reasonable proportion of their limited capital.
Like Carter and the Panama Canal Treaty.
Carter expended a large proportion of his foreign policy chips to get that through and barely managed to do it and shot a lot. It was a big decision on his part. It's hard for an administration at any time. It's harder still for an administration that's getting ready to face a re-election campaign or for an administration that's becoming a lame duck administration when it's no longer likely to face to submit itself to re-election. So the first point I want to make is that it's got to be a high priority. And for various reasons, a number of these particular treaties that we've been talking about just haven't made it onto high enough priority on the agenda or on the sort of scale of concerns of the administrations that have been dealing with them. The second point I wanted to make is that One of the big problems, I think, from the point of view of ratifying these treaties is not so much a kind of parochialism, as Doug suggested, but the Americans in the post-war period have always thought of the American empire as a liberal empire and a cosmopolitan empire. This, of course, may seem different looked at from non-American vantage points, I admit, but the Americans have always sort of portrayed themselves as broad-minded and a different kind of an empire, a liberal empire, an empire beyond reproach with respect to sensitivity and concern for all of these sorts of rights questions. After all, look at the 200-year glorious history and our sacred documents and so on. And therefore, the fact that people push these issues is somehow or other perceived within this sort of worldview as a kind of a criticism. Something that's sort of, you know, why do you need to raise these kinds of problems? Of course, it goes without saying that Pax Americana is sensitive to these kinds of things. It doesn't need to be enshrined in these documents. And the move to do so is niggling criticism that shouldn't really be made. And the third point that I wanted to raise is that as we go on now into the 80s and further into the Reagan era, awful as that may be from a lot of points of view, we are, as you all know, moving into an era in which the senior officials of the American federal government are now more and more taking a kind of a knee-jerk negative attitude toward almost anything associated with the United Nations and the specialized agencies of it. Now, it's a long story and a sad story as to why this is the case, but increasingly politically in this country, anything that can be associated with the United Nations and its connected organizations will almost automatically be regarded in a rather skeptical light at best, and more likely a negative light. And that's a very unhappy development. It's a very unfortunate thing, but it's a political reality in this country that can't be denied.
David, did you have... it's past 4:30, and I think we have to adjourn, but David and I and Rosita had to go to see the eye doctor this afternoon, but she'll be back tomorrow. We'll carry on tomorrow morning with this discussion with Sandy and Henry, and then perhaps move on to other matters. I think everyone's eager to continue the discussion tomorrow. And so I suggest that we start at our usual time, 9 a.m. precisely.
What about Washington?
Since you asked, I just happen to be carrying this around. I don't know. That
was a very good explanation that you just gave. It was real helpful.
Yeah, well, it's not. I wish it were more optimistic. But at least it explains something.
Yeah, it really helped me. It made it clear, and it enabled me to explain.
You're welcome. 212, I think. I really recognize.
Well, it sure like it came out when it just more things,
It recognized that there was serious abuse by the guerrilla movements against the indigenous population and didn't retreat from the issue that the indigenous population of the Indian Highlands of Guatemala was also being abused by the guerrilla movements. But the guerrilla movement abuse was nowhere on the level of what they call massive extrajudicial killing or massacres of Indian villages that had taken place. They also commented on the lack of right to religious freedom in Guatemala because of the suppression of the Catholic Church and the murdering of numerous Indian catechists, the lack of rights to movement and residency created by thousands of refugees and displaced persons. And their report was very important. The State Department at that time was claiming that Amnesty International had deceived international public opinion. Ronald Reagan had gone to Honduras to meet Efrain Rios Montt in December 1982, and his exact words were that Guatemala had gotten a bum rap a bum rap. And the Inter-American Commission said the people of Guatemala had gotten a bum rap. And they backed up Amnesty International, and they were looked at their criticism. The Inter-American Commission is going back to Guatemala in May. In its last meeting, it's been invited again by the new government in Guatemala. After a report that has been done by the UN Relator, a British member of the House of Parliament, House of Lords, who's done a report which is very congratulatory of the Guatemalan, or relatively congratulatory of the Guatemalan government in terms of what it's doing to its indigenous population. It has questions, the UN report, but argues that in the midst of an internal conflict between insurgents and the state, that the Guatemalan government, through its creation of model villages, is trying to resolve the problem. The Inter-American Commission will be going into the highlands to assess the model village program, the civilian patrols, and all these things that there's been a lot of publicity, and it's anyone's guess what they'll come up with, but they have been invited, and there's an enormous pressure on the commission at this point by the Guatemalan government to see a new view of Guatemala, and it's anyone's guess what they'll come up with. The final case, that's the Guatemalan case, and is the report on the mosquito that they came out with. They have been concerned with the mosquito case since 1982. In fact, the only special report that they've ever done, they've had special reports on countries, these little things on country human rights. This is the only special report they've ever done on a single case. The whole case was on the report, and it has to do with Indian rights, which makes it very significant. It's a report on the situation of the human rights of a segment of the Nicaraguan population of mosquito origin. That title tells you a lot about what the report's about. A segment of the Nicaraguan population of mosquito origin. A lot of this report has to do with, are the mosquito an ethnic group or an indigenous people with sovereign rights? They were called in by the two at the same exact day in February of 1982. Both the Nicaraguan government invited the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to investigate its relocation of the 8,500 people from the Rio Coco. At the same time that Brooklyn Rivera, Stedman Faggett, representing Misura, Brooklyn Rivera representing Misura Sata, and the Indian Law Resource Center submitted a complaint. The exact same day, a government invited the Inter-American Commission, and a set of indigenous groups, one a non-governmental organization, the Indian Law Resource Center, and two indigenous groups in exile submitted a complaint to the Inter-American Commission. So they had both a government cooperating with them and an indigenous, incredibly significant, the first time in the history that indigenous people themselves actually brought the complaint. The Guatemalan complaint was a general country study and wasn't brought by indigenous people, and all of the lowland South America were brought by non-governmental organizations or religious groups. So the first time in the history. In fact, Brooklyn Rivera and Stedman Faggett and the Council of Elders have testified before the Inter-American Commission. So they have received now oral testimony from indigenous leaders on the mosquito case. One of the things they decided to do, and the Nicaraguan government suggested this, is, well, given that the Indians are bringing the complaint and we're in